She's the media maven with her finger on the pulse of the heartbeat of Chicago. If it's happening in the Windy City, she's got you covered. Now here's the lady that puts the fun in fundraising, Candid Candace Jordan.
Hey, Candid Candace here, along with my charming and darling co-host, John St. Augustine. You know, we both figured that on this very special day, Tom Skilling's retirement, that we would reshare a previous episode of Candid Candace, the podcast, where we featured Tom Skilling. I mean, what he had to say, and this is, you know, like maybe a month ago that we filmed this, and this is when he knew, you know, that his retirement date was going to be February 28th, but it is a fascinating interview and, you know, very timely right now. And, you know, he shares insights on climate change and what it's like to ride through the eye of a hurricane, his thoughts on UFOs, and what made him cry on live TV. So I think of him as the Mr. Rogers of meteorologists, and I'm thrilled for you to hear this episode again, especially on this special day. What are your thoughts about Tom Skilling, John?
Well, my thoughts with Tom, I had the chance to work with him many times over the years when I was on WGN radio, and I would sit in, especially in the afternoons, for Gary Meyer from 3 to 7. Yeah. And Tom had a regular slot on Gary's show at like 4:05 and 5:05. He'd come on and talk for just a couple minutes after the news. Uh-huh. I was not prepared for the barrage of phone calls of people wanting to talk to Tom Terrific about the weather in French Lick, Indiana.
Tom Terrific, that's a great nickname.
Yeah.
You know, I read an article about that Bill Murray said when he heard about Tom Skilling's retirement. Murray said, you know, I don't think we're going to have weather anymore. He says, I don't even see the point of looking out the window.
And you know, that's perfect. Vintage Murray. And the best part of it for me is Tom Skilling is one of the, if not the most humble guy.
On the planet.
On the planet.
On the planet. There's no question about it. And you know, he's been at this for 46 years. That was the date of his first broadcast on WGN. And you know, he said somewhere else that he's 72 years old now, and he said that he started to suffer from vertigo, and he ties it to the stress of deadlines and fighting the traffic. So in our interview, he tells us what he plans to do, you know, after today. So you have to listen to this. It's pure Tom Skilling at his finest. And you know, last night, I think, was a weather send-off to
right.
Tom. We watched, I don't know if you saw his final, you know, but
riveted.
God, what
riveted.
Greater way to go out. And it was like he gave a master class in meteorology. And, you know, Demetrius has got really big shoes to fill.
Oh,
I don't envy him his position.
And you know what? It was like the Almighty said, Tom, you got to work the last night
yeah.
to earn this final paycheck.
That's right. It's right up his alley, though. I mean, you can see the glee in his voice, although sometimes he had to catch himself and say, you know, I'm not excited about these possible bad weather conditions,
right.
but he goes into the whole, you know, whole explanation about why they're occurring and everything else. I'm telling you, I am so going to miss this guy. But we have a great interview with him, and, you know, I know everybody's going to enjoy it. On a bright, bright, bright note, we are so lucky this
yes.
morning. Because we have got somebody who, you know, I have been an ardent fan of for as long as I've ever known of him or heard his name or seen him on television. He's the only person I trust as a meteorologist. My husband and I, if there's any bad weather, we say, where's Tom? We got to find out the real deal from Tom Skilling. And so we're so lucky to have him as our guest today.
Absolutely.
So, Tom Skilling, let's bring him on now.
My goodness, what a beautiful introduction, Candace.
Well,
it's so good to talk to you.
Well, it is. I'm so happy that you said yes. You know, I've been after you for a while to come on this podcast, and you obviously are so busy. And, you know, this is how I see you. I see you as the Mr. Rogers of meteorologists.
And, high praise indeed. I'll tell
well,
you that.
Well, it's so true. I mean, you have the most incredible demeanor. You're the most accurate of all the meteorologists. And, you know,
oh,
so you came from, you were born in Pittsburgh, then you moved
yes.
to Aurora, you know, the Chicago suburb, and you began working in broadcasting at age 14?
You know, it's something, Candace, and there was a stop in Westfield, New Jersey. My dad was a mechanical engineer by trade.
Uh-huh.
And would do the commute into New York City every day from New Jersey. So it was 13 years out there. I lived 2 years in Pittsburgh. I don't remember it. Was born there. You know, I found something interesting. Gary Meyer, with whom I used to work on radio, his
yeah.
wife was born in the same hospital I was born in, McGee Hospital out in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. And then we moved out to New Jersey, and my dad was hired, and we were transferred out here by Henry Pratt Company. That was where that terrible shooting was a couple years ago.
Oh,
but my father is long since gone, but my father sold huge industrial valves that were used in power plants and water treatment facilities, and that's what Henry Pratt Company did. So we came out here to the Midwest in 1965. I was in the seventh grade and lived in Aurora, and that's where I lived until I went off to school at the University of Wisconsin in Madison. Went worked a year in Jacksonville, Florida, in television. Then went up to Milwaukee, worked 3 years up there, and came down to Chicago to WGN in 1978. So that's kind of the whole layout there.
Well, let me ask you, who or what inspired you to make meteorology your life's work? How did you
You know what? No.
Great.
You know what?
Okay, thanks for coming on, Tom. We'll talk
later. That's it. Kind of blew that midnight out of the water. You know what? My parents could never figure out what they had done wrong. They didn't want a meteorologist. There's nobody in my family that had anything to do with meteorology. But I'll tell you something, Candace, it's been a passion of mine as long as I can remember. As a little boy, I had paper routes, and I would save money and go through instrument catalogs, all of which featured instruments I couldn't even come close to affording with my $3 and $4 a week paper route. But I dreamed of putting in Weather Service standard gear. What I ended up being able to buy was a barometer and a sling psychrometer, which is an instrument we use to measure dew point and humidity. And I followed the weather since I was a kid. Never really thinking I was going to go into media weather. I always thought I'd go to work in the Weather Service or something. Yeah. And you know, it's funny, Candace, as a youngster, my parents were wonderful. They supported me once they realized I was serious about this, but they couldn't figure out quite what I had in mind here. And I remember we were coming into a doctor's appointment here in Chicago, and I thought, I used to get on the train and come in to Woodlawn Avenue on the University of Chicago campus, which is where the then Weather Bureau, now the National Weather Service, had their forecast office. And they used to kick out the forecast for Iowa, Wisconsin, Indiana, and Illinois from that office down on Woodlawn Avenue. And so we were coming in for a doctor's appointment, and I thought, oh, I've got to get my mother, who was accompanying me because I was young, into the weather office, the Weather Service office down in the federal building. They had a public service office there. And when she sees the clacking teletypes and all the maps on the wall and all, this will convince her that her son had not made a mistake in going into meteorology. So we went into the office, and the staff there was marvelous. They were so welcoming and so accommodating. And I said to her after we left, thinking I had convinced her that her son wasn't going off the rails, wanting to go into meteorology, I said, what do you think, Mom? Isn't that interesting? And she said, if you ever work in a place like that, I'll die a thousand deaths.
Oh, and I, no.
I thought, wow, I sure blew that. But but my parents came to realize that their crazy son was serious about this, and it was marvelous. I remember my fifth grade present when we were living in New Jersey, birthday present, was they took me into the New York Weather Bureau office, and it's the first time I saw weather radar. It was at Rockefeller Center, the same building that NBC's headquarters is in, and that was the first time I saw a real weather radar. They had the Radome up on top of the RCA building there in downtown New York, and I used to listen to WNYC, the NPR station out there. You know the George Carlin bit, the hippy-dippy weatherman?
Yeah, sure.
And you know, during that, he says, now he said, he clearly listened to the broadcast on WNYC, too, because they would say, now, New York City radar shows showers 50 miles either side of a line from, you know, Poughkeepsie, New York, down to Atlantic City. But he would add, it also shows a squadron of Russian ICBMs coming in. So, you know, I wouldn't sweat the thunderstorms, you know.
Oh,
but,
God.
But they talked about that, you know, and I used to listen to that as a kid.
Oh, goodness, you got great memories. You know, I'll tell you something. I remember one time on television, and I have a screenshot of it because it was so surprising, that you cried during an eclipse.
Oh,
do you remember that?
I do. I was so embarrassed. We were
I thought that was one of the best moments on television. It was so moving. And I mean, it touched me. I mean, it shows how human you are and how much you care about what you do. And I thought, God, he's the real deal. I mean, so what moved you? So, and I mean, does it always happen like that with severe weather, or was that just a one-off?
Look, I cry in movies and all the rest, but I didn't expect to do it on live television. And I was down there. It was oppressively hot. We were down at a campground south of Carbondale, where we figured we'd get a full view of the eclipse. Mm-hmm. And I was on the air as day turned to night in the middle of the day during this eclipse. And it just overpowered me. I thought, I felt such a tiny little part of this universe when I saw nature doing this. Mm-hmm. To watch daytime blue skies turn dark and see the stars come out in what should have been the middle of the day. I don't know. I thought, and I'm on television with all kinds of people down there in this campground watching the eclipse. And I thought, I'm losing it. And I thought, no, I can't do this. And I broke down, and I was so embarrassed and to have lost it. So, but there's something about that, Candace, that was so moving. It was almost a religious experience.
Yeah, that's what it felt like when I was watching it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Is there any other memorable or challenging weather event that you covered like that that made you feel the same way? Or?
Oh, my gosh. I think I'm watching nature put the weather together. And we really, in this day and age, with the technology that we have really cracked a nut here. We really have a fighting chance of figuring out what nature's doing. You know, if I had a dime for every time somebody said to me, boy, I wish I had a job where I could be wrong every day and keep my job, you know. And if I had a dime for every time I've heard that over the years, I'd be a rich man. And I tell people, I said, the fact of the matter is, if I was wrong every day, I'd be escorted out the door so fast that I wouldn't be able to say, what in the world is going on, Ben, before I reached the door that they sent me out of.
Tom, that's not a bit true, because you were one of the most accurate reporters for meteorology of anybody. I mean, you're noted
so
for
sweet.
That. It's roundly reported, and I remember that you accurately reporting the Groundhog Day blizzard in 2011, and everybody else got that completely wrong. You're the only one that had it right.
Well, I'll tell you, Candace, I've been fortunate and blessed, and I tell the young people when we had internships before COVID, I tell young people that we are in an era in meteorology which is really stunning. There's been more progress made in weather forecasting in the last 50 years than had been made in the science back to 340 BC when Aristotle wrote his Meteorologica treatise that really kind of launched the whole profession of meteorology. It is stunning. We've got satellites, Doppler radar. We have numerical modeling of the atmosphere that's done on computers that do quadrillion operations per second. That's the kind of computing power you need to try and track this crazy and complex atmosphere of ours. And that Groundhog's Day blizzard was a perfect example of modeling at its best. And you know something else, Candace? Do you know that the first two functions to which the first mainframe computer in this country were put, and this was developed in World War II on the campus of Princeton University, the first digital computer. Back in those days, it was pre-transistor, nothing had been miniaturized, so they had huge vacuum tubes that were used, and the computer covered a square block on the campus of Princeton University.
Oh, wow.
Oppenheimer got wind of this, and he was developing the atomic bomb with his group out in Los Alamos. And the guy who oversaw this project was a Hungarian-American mathematician, John von Neumann. And he'd read a paper by Alan Turing about the universal machine, which essentially discussed what was to become computers. And he patterned his development of this mainframe computer on that. And the two Oppenheimer wanted to do calculations to perfect the atomic bomb, but von Neumann had escaped the Soviets and the Nazis, had no love for them, and he thought the ultimate weapon would be weather control. So he thought, well, this computer is going to sit dormant at night. So he put together, he said, I'm going to put together a numerical modeling team, a group of brilliant meteorologists and mathematicians who will write the equations that try to simulate how the atmosphere works, and we're going to try and run a numerical weather forecast, which had been speculated as possible since way back the beginning of the last century. And he did it. And the models were terrible, but that started computer weather forecasting in the 1940s that really didn't come out into the operational arena where we do the weather forecasting everybody sees every night, till really in the 60s and 70s. And these models have gotten better since then. And it revolutionized what we do. It's just amazing.
So, are you talking about the seeding of the clouds to do the rain, or what kind of, how?
Now, that's a separate area. That's called weather modification. You know, we're doing it inadvertently by putting, greenhouse gas into the atmosphere, and we're sending the atmosphere off its rails at times with climate change, which is, by the way, very real. It's ongoing, and we're seeing
examples of it right now. That was one of my top questions for you, Tom, because you gave seminars at Fermilab in Batavia for years about severe weather, and climate change is one of the topics. So tell me your thoughts on that. I'm sorry to interrupt you, but you just got me so excited.
Oh, no. Candace, you're not interrupting at all. I'll tell you. Climate change is insidious. It's been going on. We started throwing fossil fuels into the atmosphere really with the start of the Industrial Revolution in 1760. And the Industrial Revolution has brought us wonderful things. I mean, it's made the United States among the leading economies of the world, the leading economy of the world. Mm-hmm. But we've been putting out these emissions. And do you know something? This notion that climate scientists had, we're back in the 70s saying we're going into an ice age and that they've changed their mind, we're going to warm up now, is wrong. The fact is, scientists, there were papers out as early as the early 1800s and before the Civil War that said, boy, all this gas we're putting in the air by burning fossil fuels in our industries is going to ultimately warm the atmosphere. They knew about this before the Civil War. And by the turn of last century, the late 1800s, there was even an Irish scientist who calculated how much the Arctic regions he thought would warm by adding doubling and tripling CO2 content. His forecasts back in 1898 have turned out to be absolutely accurate. And contrary to a couple of articles that were run in the 1970s by outlier scientists saying we're heading toward an ice age, that was not the conventional view of most climate scientists. Most climate scientists knew we were going to warm, and that notion continues to this day, and it's happening. It really is.
So just real quick, to back up everything Tom's saying, and he and I talked a little bit about this the other day.
Behind my back.
Yeah, that happens quite often, actually. you take notes, I cock behind your back.
Okay, I see where this is going.
Yeah, well, this is a good one because I met, both of you know that Bill Curtis and I did this Earth Matters series for 3 years. And
you sure did. And marvelous.
Thanks. And episode 199 is about Tom. So I thought on the heels of what he was just talking about, let's put our ears on this.
He might just be the most trusted weatherman in the business. Millions rely on his predictions, and he has a lot to say about climate change. As the chief meteorologist for WGN in Chicago and across America for the past 37 years, Tom Skilling has been studying weather patterns. And when it comes to climate change, he says our planet is on a record-shattering streak. Atmospheric concentrations of carbon dioxide are now over 400 parts per million. This is the first time in more than 800,000 years that there has been this much carbon in the atmosphere. When baseball got out of whack, congressional hearings led to modifications to America's national pastime. However, it's become apparent that Congress is not inclined to act on stemming the pollution that leads to the extreme weather-causing climate change that we're experiencing. If we trust him for the everyday weather, maybe we should pay close attention to his long-term forecast as well. I'm Bill Curtis for Earth Matters.
Yeah.
Wow.
So, yeah. So that's...
To have Bill Curtis say that, and I know you were very much involved with that. It was flattering, but you guys were covering this subject long before I was talking about it.
Well, you know, and the thing, interesting thing is, and I, as a point of production, because we all work in the media on some level, to create 1 minute, I had to do about 3 hours of research to get everything correct. You know how this works, right?
Yeah,
and then
absolutely.
I have to get it down to 166 words for Bill to read a certain cadence. Wow. And to try and take everything you've accomplished, Tom, and put it into some sort of digestible audio bit, there was always a challenge doing all of them. But I'm thinking, you know, we're dealing with this with you. And that thought came to my mind, you know, you and I did some work together on WGN. Often I would sit in, and Gary Meyer might be off, and he would say to me, just, you know, gird your loins, because when Tom comes out at 4 o'clock and 5 o'clock, the phone lines are going to melt down, because people would literally wait on hold 20 minutes to call WGN to see what the weather was like in Kokomo.
Well, I'd wait that long to talk to Tom.
Well, I'll tell you something. I am so blessed to have worked at WGN, where they've given me time on the air. Every time I meet colleagues, they say, "How do you get all that time on the air?" And I said, "You know, they made a mistake. They allowed me to develop a following over the years, and now they can't rein me in." But and I used to scare the news consultants when I worked up in Milwaukee and all. They had news consultants come in and said, "You use terms like jet stream and dew point. You shouldn't do that. Nobody knows what that means." And the only thing I could say as a young man who knew they held your career in their hands was, look, if you don't discuss it, how's anybody going to know what it means? And besides that, this is not brain surgery. When you show an upper air map, you're just showing where the weather's coming from. It speaks volumes. And it's not hard to comprehend. And my viewers over the years, you know, I've never had anybody complain about an isobar on a weather map or the use of the term jet stream. People are not dumb. They underestimate the knowledge of our viewers. People are fascinated.
Let me just ask one more question. I'll throw it back to Candace. So,
no, that's right.
So, you know, knowing, and I've been to a couple of your live events, and they're very thorough, and you got these massive audiences there. And every night they're watching you on WGN. And I'm wondering, at some point, you know, there's a responsibility factor, you know, meaning, just like we heard in the Earth Matters piece, you know, you're a voice now and have been for climate change and and global warming and all those type of things, which isn't always shared by some of your colleagues. So, but the thing I think that makes it different is you travel so much. You've gone to Alaska, you go to Hawaii, you see these things in real time, and then you bring it back to us, the viewers. Do you feel like a more of a responsibility now for this than you did when you started?
Well, I think that's grown. You know, John, my view on this has really evolved. You know, as a young forecaster, I used to read the forecasts of the Arctic melting and all, and I thought, how physically is that going to happen? You're going to have to prove this to me. Well, I've had over a half a century of watching the atmosphere, and it's doing things now I never would have believed it would do. We see these blocking patterns. For instance, we spent a summer with our skies filled with smoke from record Canadian wildfires. We've had smoke coming in from fires burning our western U.S. year after year after year. And these fires are being exacerbated by heat and drought. I was at a climate conference in Washington, D.C. with Congressman Kasten invited me out there. And there were various senators and congresspeople who brought constituents in to describe how climate change was affecting their constituencies all around the country. And there was a fellow there who was the fire chief from Reno, Nevada, who had left a fire burning 14 miles from his home out in Nevada to come to this conference. And I said to him, "Chief, I said, these fires out in the West, these have got to be frightening." He said, "Tom, I've been doing this for 30 years. And he said, the nature of the fires burning today is like nothing I've ever seen. He said, they burn fast, they spread, they essentially are uncontrollable. And he said, they spread like wildfire." And this is, you know, people can get into the forestry and how we maintain our forest. The fact of the matter is, when you've got underlying drought and heat, any fire that starts is going to spread faster and hotter and burn more intensely. And that's what's going on out West. And we've spent the summer under all this smoke coming in off these there was a blocking pattern, what's known in the atmosphere as a blocking pattern. It was a dome of warm air that our computer models accurately predicted. When we saw these forecasts, you looked at this and you thought, I've never seen anything like this pattern in my life. It'll be interesting to see if it works out. And you knew this was a warning sign that there was going to be trouble. And indeed, there was. The fires started in Canada and they burned all summer, well into the autumn. It's stunning.
Well, you know, I want to say, besides the meteorology and your broadcast, you've had some film experience, too. That you were consulted on the movie The Weatherman.
Oh!
And I'm just wondering, what kind of advice did they ask from you?
You know, it was interesting, Candace. I was sitting in my office, and at the time I had little offices back behind the news set in the studio. And I had maps hanging all over the wall. The offices looked like a disaster area, you know. And so all of a sudden, these little entourages would come through the office. And I didn't know who these people were. And one group came through one week, and I said, who was that? And they said, oh, it's a Paramount Pictures advance crew. They're thinking of doing some movie on a weatherman. So I thought, oh, well, that's interesting. And then a week later, another entourage, a little larger, came through. I said, is that the Paramount group? They said, yeah. And finally, a larger audience or group came through. And this included the director of the movie Weatherman, which was to star Nicolas Cage. And at the end, he stopped. They were asking me, why do you have these maps here? What does this show? What are you looking at here? What do you do all day long? And it was an interesting insight. What they wanted to do was replicate, as a little part of this movie, a real weather office. And I must say, it's impressive when you see how Hollywood endeavors to create, you know, a realistic view of what a weather office looks like. And what I was to do was to work with Nicolas Cage and explain to him chroma key, for instance, standing in front of a green screen. And I thought, I'm telling Nicolas Cage how to perform. This is crazy. He ought to be telling me how to do things, you know. But it was very interesting. They shot one segment. The story involved a weather meteorologist, a TV weatherman, who was going through a divorce and brokenhearted about it. And he had just been offered, he was doing local weather, a chance to do a network weather program. And so they went through what his life was like. And we filmed the local station part of it at WGN one weekend. And then we went down to NBC Tower. And that was the setting for his network job. Mm-hmm. And it was interesting to do that. And essentially, I was to look at what they were doing and say, how realistic is his weather presentation? And I remember them asking me to explain to Nicolas how chroma key works, the green screen where you don't really have anything up there, but they electronically superimpose the maps behind the weathercaster. And I told him, I said, you know, Nicolas, for me to be telling you anything about, performing is pretty crazy, but what a fascinating experience. He was very nice. And the director who went on to produce the Pirates of the Caribbean series was so nice. It's such a sharp crew.
Oh, God. Well, that was a fabulous movie. And, they said that it was based on you, sort of. I mean, it seems to be true.
Well, you know what, Candace, I've never been married, so I've been married in this career all my life, but it was interesting. They wanted, for some reason, snow on the ground, and that was a winter where it didn't snow. And I remember they would keep calling me and saying, when is there going to be snow on the ground? And what they had to do in post-processing that movie was go in, and apparently they did it at some facility up in Minneapolis where they laid snow in. Part of it was shot up in Evanston. Part of it was shot on the Chicago lakefront.
Oh, my goodness.
And then other parts in our weather office. And they actually post-produced the snow cover before it went, you know, on the big screen. It was interesting.
Well, now that you brought it up, how does that green screen work? I couldn't imagine in a million years how to figure out something like that. What are you looking at when you're pointing to that screen? Is there something projected somewhere else where you know where all the cities are?
You know what? The way this works is, and the reason they did it is essentially you're inserting yourself as a video tour guide on the graphic that you're describing. And for a long time, they couldn't rear screen project graphics in a clear way. So what they did was they stand in front of a green screen, and they can, in the control room, remove the green and put a map in from another source, from a computer. And then you stand and you look at a monitor off of the side, and they also pump it into a monitor mounted on the camera itself that you're speaking to. You use the same screen that the anchors use with their script, new script in it, only they switch it. They switch it to a line feed so I can see what the viewer is seeing at home, and you kind of gauge where you're pointing that way. So it's really... it's quite a fascinating process.
That's so cool. But you know, your broadcasts have always been known for the technology and the computer imagery. And how did that come about? And do you have a lot of input into that, the way it looks? Because it really looks way more professional and intricate than anybody else's that I've seen.
You know, kid, thank you for saying that. That's so nice. Do you know something? When my first 3 years was up here at WGN, my first contract, I came to work at WGN in 1978. And the Milwaukee station I'd worked at called me up, and the program director had ascended to the general manager role. And he called me up and said, "Look, Tom, I've just been named general manager, and my first act is to try and get you back here to Milwaukee." And so I thought, well, I got a little negotiating power here. So I said, "Well, tell me." So his name was Andy Potis. I said, "Tell me, Andy, would you consider computer graphics were just starting to come online?" Mm-hmm. And I said, "Would you consider computerizing our graphics?" Yeah, he said. And so anyway, I went to my bosses at WGN. I said, "Look, I'll be honest with you. Milwaukee's offered me a job back." And at the time, WGN was owned by the Tribune Company, and there was a case in the Supreme Court about newspaper broadcast cross-ownerships that was being decided. There was a chance that the Tribune Company would have to spin off WGN if the Supreme Court decided they weren't going to grandfather clause a newspaper company owning a TV station in the same market. So they didn't put a lot of money into the upgrading the equipment. And we had trouble even chromaking stuff because the equipment was so old. The Supreme Court later decided to grandfather clause newspaper broadcast cross-ownerships. And then the pocketbooks opened up, and we overnight transformed into a modern facility. But at that point, when Milwaukee came to me, we were still painting maps on plexiglass boards and all.
Jeez.
And I thought, you know, this is not where we're going. I knew this company up in Minneapolis, the computer company, was using folks from the University of Wisconsin's MacITus and satellite program. Do you know the University of Wisconsin-Madison is the birthplace of satellite meteorology? There was a professor up there by the name of Werner Sumi, who it pictured a world in which we had satellite platforms spaced all around the planet so we could watch every weather system from space from birth to death. That was a revolutionary concept back in the 60s, and it's come into being. But they figured out ways to look at the 70% of the planet that's covered by water and calculate what the winds are doing and how the moisture is distributed. And that could be fed into computers then and help produce the computer model forecasts we use today. Yeah. I knew their people were going to work up at this Minneapolis computer company. So I said to my bosses at WGN, "Look, Milwaukee's approached me and I'd like to look at that." And they said, "Well, what makes you think we aren't going to computerize?" He said, I remember our news director, Paul Davis, said to me, "Look, if you'll stay with us, the next year you and I are going to go to radio television news directors conferences where they show this computer gear, these computer companies set up examples of what they're doing, and we're going to find a computer graphics system." So we computerized our graphics 2.5 years before any other station in Chicago did. Mm-hmm. And the technology was in its infancy, and it was a nightmare. I mean, it was full of bugs. We'd have little power surges, and it would erase 6 to 8 hours of work I'd put into creating animated.
No.
Oh, it was awful. And but what we did on the air was really amazing because we showed the weather moving into the future.
Yeah.
And I'd spent hours putting that stuff together. And it worked. It did. And so at any rate, so that's how that came into being.
Oh, that's so interesting. Boy, you put a lot of work into that, but it showed right away. I mean, you're miles ahead of anybody else. So let me tell you, we were talking before we got on air about where I met you. And, you know, you've won so many awards, Emmys and this and that. But I sat at your table, believe it or not, in 2015 for the Chicago International Film Festival Television Awards, where you were the honoree. Do you remember being honored for that?
I do. I was surprised as heck. I got a call from the folks there, and they said, we're gonna feature you. Would you be okay with that? And I wasn't quite sure what it was, but I said, sure. I was honored that anybody would think of honoring me.
Oh, of course. So, well, you know, the founder, Michael Kutza, said that they had been trying to get you to be an honoree for the longest, but you were so busy, they couldn't work around your schedule.
Oh,
so
for heaven's sakes.
I was so thrilled, and I was so honored to sit at your table. But let me ask you, of all the awards, and maybe not just an award, but what are you most proud of for all your career in broadcasting? What are you most proud of?
You know something, there's so many things, Candace, as I look back. You're so busy doing it, you don't have time to think about it, you know? And now, as I approach retirement from at least the day-to-day duties, I think the Fermilab Tornado Seminars that we did every year, 38 years we put those on. I used to fly the guest speakers in, and we'd set up hotel reservations for folks. And the meteorological community responded amazingly. We had literally the who's who of science researchers on severe weather and science, the forecasters coming in from all over the country. And a friend of mine who later ascended to the head position of the National Weather Service, Louis Uccellini. Louis was studying for his doctorate when I was going to the University of Wisconsin. And a group of us used to gather in the fax room up there, grad students, and I was the one undergrad who would show up. And when snowstorms were coming in, we'd all be there reading the maps. And I was so interested in what these grad students were looking at. What sort of data were they considering important as these storms developed to see how the whole thing would unfold? So I met Louis, and I remember one day the phone rang in the office in the middle of our doing these Fermilab programs that started in the early 80s and ran for 38 years.
Wow.
And I stopped doing them only because I wanted to focus on doing climate change talks, which I've been doing. But the phone rang one day in the office, and this voice comes on the other end and says, how'd you like the head of the Weather Service to speak at your Fermilab Tornado Seminar? We had thousands who would show up every year out at Fermilab, the beautiful auditorium out there. And it was a perfect venue in which to do this sort of thing because they could put all kinds of graphics and animations up that all of our speakers would want to incorporate in their talks.
Mm-hmm.
And year after year after year, people would show up for this. It kind of surprised us. And Fermilab told me it was the biggest event they had every year out there in terms of audience participation.
Yeah.
So I was very proud of that. I thought this was a unique chance for people to actually see the scientists who are doing the work.
Right.
You know, they see us talking head media types, but I wanted them to meet the kind of people that were really doing the grassroots work, both at the Weather Service and research organizations, NASA, and all the rest. And I feel the same way about my climate change talks. You know, it's been such a politicized issue. And yet these researchers are some of the most apolitical people I've ever run into doing this research on climate change. And there's all kinds of mythology around among climate deniers that these people are getting rich off research grants. I always kid the researchers. I said, well, how's the yacht going now? And what about do you have your jet yet and a private jet? And they laugh because nobody's making that kind of money off the research being done. This is being done for sheer passion and concern about future generations. Mm-hmm. So I think the Fermilab experience and the kind of people and the the amazing response of those in my profession to come out and give us of their time and expertise to speak. And the audience, our wonderful audience, who would come out and drink this up. I mean, it was I had Ted Fujita, the tornado researcher at the University of Chicago, who revolutionized our understanding of tornadoes. You know, when he started his research, he was one of the young Japanese scientists called into Hiroshima and Nagasaki to figure out what in the, by the Japanese government, to figure what in the world had just happened. And he talked very openly about what he saw as a young scientist. There were five of them called into Hiroshima. And he said everything was leveled. But he noticed around the periphery of the bomb site that there was twisted debris. And he realized there had been fire tornadoes that had been developed by the tremendous heat of the bomb. And he became interested in atmospheric vortices. And from that grew his interest in tornadoes. And he'd written a paper on thunderstorms over Mount Fuji that caught the eye of the head of the Atmospheric Sciences Department at the University of Chicago, who then offered him a chance to come to this country and start researching tornadoes at the University of Chicago. And of course, today, the Fujita Index is the scale by which we assess, this was developed by Dr. Fujita, the scale by which we assess the intensity of tornadoes.
Oh, you know, for goodness sake.
Wow. When you hear that a tornado is an EF5 or an EF4, that was Fujita who came up with that scale. And it's been modified to update, you know, new scientific knowledge about what kinds of winds produce what kind of damage. But he was amazing. He had a little machine. He made tornadoes down at the University of Chicago. And he had these little Lionel train set train stations and houses. And he would move one of these little laboratory tornadoes over them and film it. And the way the buildings, the little model buildings, came apart, so he could better understand what kind of winds were producing damage. He also, he had these wires he could plug in and they would heat up, and he'd create a little laboratory tornado, and then he would turn these wires on that would go red hot, and you'd watch the circulation of the tornado break up. And he was trying to simulate what effect a city has on tornadoes and the heat that a city produces.
And goodness.
While tornadoes will still come through a city, weaker tornadoes will be weakened by the heat released by a city. And he proved that in his little laboratory scale.
Tornadoes in his little laboratory. I absolutely love it.
Candace, we used to think that tornadoes, before Fujita really dug into this, we used to think they had winds of 1,000 miles per hour. He would take 8mm movies and look frame by frame by frame at debris blowing as these tornadoes tore a building apart. And he calculated that the top wind speed in a tornado was probably more like 320 miles per hour. And you know, since then, Doppler radars, which can measure the wind speeds in a tornado, have found that the most intense tornado has a wind speed of 318 miles an hour.
So my gosh.
His calculation was right.
Unbelievable. Goodness. You know, I always thought that it was so crazy. Those people that go up in the planes during the tornadoes to go inside the tornadoes.
The hurricanes.
How incredibly dangerous is that? And who would be stupid enough to get in a plane and go in the eye of a tornado?
Do you know what? I've flown into a hurricane. When I worked a year in Jacksonville, Florida, and the Navy did recon flights out of the Jacksonville Naval Air Station. So I was able to jump on board one of those when I was working in the NBC affiliate down there. And we went into a hurricane, and the Navy flies in at 500 feet. I've subsequently gone in with the Air Force. They fly out of Biloxi, Keesler Air Force Base in Biloxi, among other places. And they send planes into these, and they drop instrument payloads in it to measure it. Now we send drones in, and we also have these sail craft that float in on ocean level, because they're trying to measure the interaction between the atmosphere and the ocean, which we think is very much involved in the intensification that's going on with incredible speed these days in these hurricanes. Look what happened with Hurricane Otis going into Acapulco just, in the last couple of weeks. This storm exploded out of nowhere. It went from 65 mile per hour winds to 165 mile per hour winds in 12 hours.
Oh, goodness.
The warmer oceans are seeding faster development of these storms. Mm. And this is a real problem because it takes 3 days to evacuate a population from a coastline in this country. And therefore, the longer lead time we can give people to get out of the way of these storms, and the better we are at predicting intensification, which we need a lot of work on yet.
Sure.
The more apt we are to get people out of harm's way.
Yeah. I have to get back to you flying into the hurricane. Weren't you scared?
No, I was too fascinated by what was going on. You know what?
Well, what did really you see? Isn't it all cloud cover? Or what? I mean,
no.
How did it feel? Was the plane shaking like a rattlesnake or what?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I'll tell you something. We left Jacksonville. We met this hurricane off Cape Hatteras, North Carolina. And you crisscross the storm in these missions for 12 hours. Mm-hmm. And they have instruments that are taking temperatures. The amazing thing about a hurricane, unlike storms in our part of the world, is it's uniformly warm. And I remember they had a thermometer on there that measured the temperature to a thousandth of a degree Celsius. And that needle crisscrossing this storm never moved until that night when we were off New England and the storm started pulling cool air off the landmass into the hurricane. At that point, the eye closes up and the storm loses its tropical characteristic. It becomes a non-tropical storm, but it's still a powerful system. And what you do on this, Candace, is at 500 feet, you look down on the state of the ocean. And when you hit minimal hurricane force winds, the winds shear the top off the waves. And what you're seeing is a sea of white below you with green streaks through it where the waves are being sheared off by the wind. And when we hit 90 mile an hour winds, the whole ocean surface goes white. And they could tell, they had instruments measuring wind speeds and radars and so forth, Doppler radars. But by visually looking at the state of the ocean below, you can estimate what the winds are.
Oh,
and so it's amazing. But you know, I'll tell you something funny. We spent 12 hours going back and forth across this hurricane. And hurricanes made up of these spiraling bands of thunderstorms. So they try to fly between these bands. And then when they go through the eye wall, which is a donut of strong winds where the hurricane's strongest winds are, you've got to bust through. And that's a rough ride until you get
into the calm eye. I'd be dead in my seat. Completely dead in my seat. I'm afraid to fly in good weather. I can't believe you could do that.
Well, here's the funniest thing, Candace. We spent 12 hours in a hurricane, and then we at midnight, we were done, and we started back to Jacksonville, Florida, and we hit these non-hurricane-related thunderstorms over the Gulf Stream off Jacksonville. Those were the ones that were really frightening. And they allowed me to walk through the plane, and you could stand behind the radar operator and see his radar scope. And you'd watch as we were moving through this narrow little corridor between thunderstorms. And they had railing, you know, that you could grab onto because the plane would start doing these ups and downs. And you could tell when you were going to hit turbulence. And the lightning was flashing, how these pilots could figure out where they were going. It was something. But it was the non-hurricane thunderstorms that were more frightening than the hurricane itself. So
isn't
it was
that something?
Yeah.
Well, let me ask you, what advice would you give to young meteorologists who are just starting their careers?
Love it. Have fun with it. Be too dumb to know that you're not supposed to be able to do what you want to do and go for it. honestly, I mean, if there's one theme of my career, it's being just, you know, when we moved from New Jersey out to Aurora, my dad was transferred. I used to get a weather map publication put out from Washington, D.C. by the superintendent of documents. I'd get it the next day in New Jersey by mail. But when I came out here, I was getting it 4 days later. So I thought, boy, a radio station could do anything. I wrote the local hometown radio station and had the audacity to suggest to them I could do a better forecast than they were getting out of Chicago 40 miles away. And so I said, if you could get me some weather maps, I had the audacity to suggest to them that I, as a 14-year-old in high school, junior going into high school, would do a forecast. And they were intrigued by the idea. And we drove in, and the weather service, the weather bureau then said, yeah, if you give us self-addressed stamped envelopes, they hand plotted a lot of maps in those days down on the University of Chicago campus, and they ran a copy of a surface map and an upper air map and sent it to me, and I picked it up at the post office. And before I went to high school, I'd do a broadcast in the morning, and then when I came home, I did one in the evening, and that started the media career. But, you know, I didn't even tell my parents what I was doing. And I came home from high school. My mother said, some radio station is calling for you. What? And I had to come clean and tell them what I had done. And my mother looked at me and said, well, you don't really think they're going to be interested. I said, Mom, I was trying to get some weather maps. You know, this is pre-internet.
Yeah.
And a young kid interested in the weather couldn't go online like young people
can. Right.
Young people today have access to all this stuff. It's amazing.
Well, you know, one of the things that I love too about your broadcast is that you use those photos that people send in. And I know that people contact you all the time with things about the weather and your opinions. And I wonder if anyone has ever called in a UFO sighting.
You know what? The other night that happened with these Starlink satellite constellations. This is where you know, Starlink, it's one of Elon Musk's companies that puts these things up. They're little tiny satellites, and they launch them, you know, a bunch of them at a time. They're like something under 5,000 now in orbit, and they're designed to relay internet communications to regions where people can't get internet connections. They've been using them over in Ukraine as part of the war process. But anyway, these things fly across the sky in groups. They're arranged in lines of little dots. They look like stars that are moving in unison across the sky. And they're actually little satellites. So people were calling in and saying, we've seen UFOs and all. And they're really just Elon Musk's Starlink satellites.
I love
it. So we do get reports like that. Yeah.
Interesting. You know, I know that your last broadcast is going to be February 28th, 2024. Yeah. So
yes.
I want to ask you, and I know that you've worked from 8 a.m. to 11 p.m. for 45 years, which I cannot even believe. I mean, it's an incredible work ethic. But as you retire, what do you hope your legacy will be in the field? And how do you plan on celebrating on that final broadcast night?
Oh, gosh. You know, Candace, I have no idea. This reaching the decision, I'll be 72 on February 20th. That's my birthday. And you know what finally kicked me over the top in thinking about this? I just got tired of fighting the traffic. I started at 8 in the morning, and I pulled out pictures from viewers and blog, and I pulled out all my model stuff. It's really quite, there's a lot of work involved in that.
I can imagine. Yeah.
People think that you sit there with your feet up on a desk between shows, and but that's not the way it works. At any rate, the traffic just got crazy. And
if it's just traffic, don't you think that WGN should either fly you into the studio or send a limousine for you? That's what I would do.
You know, I'll tell you, I think I'd still be stressed just looking at the traffic I was going through. You know what else, too? I started having these vertigo attacks, and I think your body tells you at one time, you know, when your body starts doing strange things like that, you think to yourself, maybe it's time to shift gears a little bit. I'm not walking away from this. I'm not going to disappear. I don't know what my new life will be like exactly, but I've got some ideas. In fact, John and I were talking about one.
Well, tell me, what ideas?
Well, you know what? Steve Bertrand, who does radio news at WGN, started with a partner, a travel agency, and I was laying in bed, and I thought, you know, I've been going to Alaska since 1980. I love it up there, and I've been going recently out to Hawaii. And I thought, you know, we did a climate change series, and we went up there to look at the melting glaciers. And I said to Steve, Steve, I was laying in bed thinking about this. I said, what would you think of me guiding? Would you be interested in helping me? Because I don't know how to organize a trip like this, but I know you're doing this. What would you think of me guiding a group up to Alaska, taking in the beauty of this state and visiting sites where the glaciers are actually retreating to see what's happening, because the Arctic is warming fast, three times the speed of anywhere else on the planet. And in the years I've been going since 1980 to Alaska, the changes up there have been stunning. Doesn't mean it doesn't snow. In fact, they just had a big 65-inch snowstorm north of Valdez, Alaska. People don't realize, you know, they think the climate change means it shouldn't snow anymore and that winters are all going to be warm. Doesn't mean that at all. It means that the area that gets snow is shrinking and the intensity and the frequency of intense snows is declining. But when you get snow, because the warmer atmosphere has more moisture in it, you can actually get more snow in this global changing atmosphere where it does snow. It just doesn't snow as often or over as much area. They had 65 inches of snow north of Valdez, Alaska. That would be like three Chicago blizzards of 67 occurring in a 24-hour period. We got 24 inches out of that snowstorm. Can you imagine that? I mean, it's just, those are in the mountains up there, but at any rate, the weather up there is fascinating. It's one of the reasons I went up there. I wanted to see what high latitude weather was going to be like. And it's been a lifelong, but I, you know, fascination of mine. But that's one idea that comes to now, whether it'll work out, we'll see. But it's an idea I have. And ultimately expanded to go to Hawaii and see what's going on out there. You heard about what happened on Maui, that fire that burned out. Yeah, destroyed Lahaina on Maui. They're in drought out there. And so there are examples of climate change going on all over the place. And I think it might be interesting for folks to see that.
Oh, God. Well, I'd take one of your tours in a heartbeat. So, you know, I'll promote it all over. I think that's a great idea. Well, I love your love for the weather, and I love your passion. But most of all, I love your big, big heart. I mean, you, even if you weren't accurate, I would want to see you on television and watch your broadcast. So
You are so sweet.
No, you bring such joy, and you're one of the most believable and likable figures on television, and I'm just so thrilled and honored that you were here today to talk to us, because you can tell I'm a fangirl, so I just thank you for being here with us. And
Candace,
any parting words you want to leave for our audience?
Well, I'll tell you one thing. The one disappointment I've had is over the years, I've gotten mail from people. I can't try and handle that all myself. There's so many people I haven't gotten back to. I've got letters since this resignation thing. I don't know how I'm ever going to answer all of them. you know, the love that people have poured out, I feel like, who is the comedian on Saturday Night Live who said, I am not worthy? Dana Carvey. You know, I feel that way. And I have been so blessed by an incredible audience, and I just love folks. And I want them to know I'm not going away. I'm just getting out of the day-to-day stuff, and I hope to interact with a lot of folks. But Candace, for you to offer me this chance to talk with you, this has been an absolute delight.
You are a doll. Believe me, let me tell you one thing. You are very worthy, and we'll all be waiting for your next chapter.
So thank you. So sweet.
Thank you from the bottom of our hearts for being here today.
Right back
Just
at
you,
Candace.
Take care, Tom.
John,
so
good
much.
To talk to you.
Always,
you
always.
All right.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye, guys.
So that's fantastic. It proves everything you and I have been talking about with this guy. I remember going to an all-day lecture. It wasn't supposed to be an all-day lecture, but when Tom gets on a roll, he gets on a roll. He was at the College of DuPage or something doing a climate change thing, and I went to see him. And, I mean, to see standing room only for weather is fascinating to me.
Well, nobody shares the news like he does. And, he's not going away. I mean, you know, this guy is far from retiring, in my opinion. And it's said that in May, he's going to take place with the ceremony surrounding the turning on of the Buckingham Fountain. And he also said that he's going to go back from time to time to fill in or to, you know, be part of, you know, severe weather conditions to comment on it. So, you know, thank God we have not seen or heard the last of this spectacular human being, Tom Skilling.
Every time I hear the word isobars, I will think of Tom.
You and me both. Well, I hope you enjoyed this episode. Thanks for listening in.
Thanks for listening to the Candid Candace podcast. For more of what's going on in Chicago, go to CandidCandace.com.